Mamy wreszcie niezależne, samorządne związki zawodowe.
September 1980. Solidarity is founded in Poland's Gdańsk shipyard, the first free trade union in the Soviet bloc. Viewed through history's lens, it looks like a tipping point, the beginning of the end of the Soviet Empire. George Soros helped to fund Solidarity, and if we tighten our zoom and focus down hard on this period, we find him doing what he's often done, working quietly behind the scenes to give history a nudge. Miklós Horáthy was part of the dissident movement in Hungary, and the first time he met George Soros, he was seeking financial support for his underground newspapers.
It was very memorable because while he received me, he was working. And the way he worked at that time was through telex. And telex was working in the neighboring room, divided by a curtain. And suddenly, a hand is reaching out from behind the curtain and gives him a sheet of paper, and he made some notes and calculations, obviously financial decisions, and handed it back to him, and we continued the conversation. So that gave to me a snapshot of his two personalities at once.
So he was, at the same time that he was talking to you, finding out about the position of dissidents in Hungary, he was also busy making money.
That's right, and it was both nice and symbolic.
George Soros is trying to give history a nudge again now, in Britain. His fortune today is estimated to be £8 billion, and this week we learnt that he's putting his financial muscle behind the push for a second referendum on our membership of the EU. And not for the first time in his life, he's made some very vocal enemies.
I do not want a second referendum, Mr. Soros. We've had one. We have made our minds up in the greatest democratic exercise in the history of this country. But if you and your friends and amongst the international business and political elites force it upon us, well, then we'll have to beat you again, this time by a much bigger margin.
The former UKIP leader, Nigel Farage. George Soros's first encounter with history came when he was still a child. He was born into a Jewish family in the Hungarian capital, Budapest, in 1930. Humphrey Tonkin, a retired senior academic now living in Connecticut, knows him well.
They were prosperous, middle-class people living in Budapest. They had a flat in the centre of town and also a summer house on the Danube, and they kind of alternated between those two. They were very much a part of the assimilated Jewish community of that period in Budapest.
Hungary began World War II as one of Hitler's allies, but in the spring of 1944, the Nazis occupied the country and the mass deportation of Jews began. The family went underground. George's father, Tivadar, left behind a memoir of those years, and it was translated by Humphrey Tonkin.
Tivadar, by the way, talks frequently in the book about the idea of assuming protective colouring. What you do is stay in plain sight, but camouflage yourself. And that's very much the way in which he went about dealing with the problems of survival during the war.
One of the oddest of the many accusations made against George Soros over the years relates to this chapter of his life. It's that, when he was barely into his teens and living through the Holocaust, he collaborated with the Nazis. Humphrey Tonkin again.
George was asked by the Jewish Council to serve as a courier to deliver messages to families, telling them to turn out on some particular occasion, when they would, of course, have been carted off to Auschwitz. And George took them home to his father. His father immediately realized what they were and said to George, deliver the messages, but tell people that they're going to be deported if they actually respond to the messages. But that has got distorted into collaboration with the Nazis.
Soros Sr., much admired by his son, was a committed internationalist. and he became an enthusiast for the experimental international language Esperanto. The name Soros, which the family adopted to disguise their Jewish origins, means to soar in Esperanto. And it was Esperanto that provided George Soros's way out of post-war Hungary.
George went to an Esperanto youth meeting in Ipswich and stayed afterwards in Britain. And we still have, by the way, we still have the minutes of this meeting in 1947. And George gives a splendid speech about the importance of spreading Esperanto across Europe with a plan to send young Esperantists out riding bicycles around Europe, spreading the word of Esperanto. As far as I know, that actually never happened, but it's a great idea.
George Soros's flair for making money and his love of big ideas both began here in Britain. He studied at the London School of Economics under the philosopher Karl Popper, whose wartime book, The Open Society and Its Enemies, is one of the great democratic manifestos of the 20th century. The Hungarian political activist Miklós Harasti.
Deep in his heart, he is a philosopher.
How important do you think his time in London studying under Karl Popper was in that context?
I think it was decisive. It's well known that his foundations are named Open Society because of that very important book of Karl Popper, which refuted, I think for good, the teleologic thinking that's behind communism, and it's a modern version of free will philosophy. The world is what you make of it.
He took time to get going in his financial career. He worked as a railway porter, a waiter, and, as his own book puts it, an unsuccessful tobacco salesman before securing his first city job at a merchant bank. In the mid-1950s, he moved to Wall Street to work in arbitrage, the high art of making large amounts of money from small price differences. And in 1969, he set up the Double Eagle Hedge Fund. Jennifer Arblan is the editor of US Investments at Thomson Reuters.
He was one of the pioneers of macro trading, and of course, as one of the world's richest men and most influential hedge fund investors, a lot of hedge fund managers, if you were to have conversations about what their goals are, George Soros's name comes up because his returns of about 20% a year on average is just very difficult to replicate these days.
1987 saw a modern Wall Street crash. The collapse in American share prices on what became known as Black Monday cost George Soros an estimated $650 million. Leon Botstein is the president of Bard College, a liberal arts college in New York State, and has been one of George Soros's closest friends for many years.
I was with him for dinner in the crash of 87, where he lost a lot of money, and I was amazed by the equanimity, the grace with which he actually realized that he had been on the wrong side of some kind of transaction.
The cool nerves paid dividends. George Soros had made much of it back within weeks and closed the year in profit. 5 years later, there was another black day of the week. Not black for George Soros, though. Black for the British government and the then-Chancellor, Norman Lamont.
The most famous of Soros putting a lot of money behind what he thought was a very high conviction idea was Black Wednesday in 1992, when he famously, quote, broke the Bank of England.
Lawrence Dudevang is the hedge fund correspondent at Thomson Reuters in New York.
He made $1 billion betting that the Bank of England would be forced to devalue the pound. And he was so sure of the idea that he put $10 billion into the trade to make that sum.
The money George Soros made on Black Wednesday was certainly enough to give him the status of master of the universe in the markets. But he's never been associated with the kind of conspicuous consumption that title evoked in the 1980s and early 90s. He spent his money instead trying to give practical expression to those big ideas about the open society, which he'd learnt about from Karl Popper back at the LSE after the war. Putting money into projects in apartheid South Africa, fanning the fires of change in Central and Eastern Europe, and, in the 1990s, donating big money to the Balkans. Laura Silber met him when she was reporting the wars there. She's now the communications director of his Open Society Foundations.
He gave money, for example, to people of Sarajevo so that who were under siege, that they could plant seeds or to end, help reconstruct water. There was no water supply, or to restore electricity. So the money that he gave to Bosnia was humanitarian, but under humanitarian, he also included newsprint because the newspaper was unable to publish.
Laura Silber is now the communications director of his Open Society Foundations. It's estimated that to date, George Soros has spent $16 billion on his Open Society philanthropy. But has it made a difference? Anna Porter spent 3 years examining the evidence and published her conclusions in a book called Buying a Better World.
I was all set to think that George Soros was some kind of messiah. But the conclusion I reached was that, unfortunately, it had not worked. They didn't become open societies. They became, many of them became very repressive. He spent more than $1 billion in Russia alone. And I think you'd have to be a little bit wacky to argue that Russia is an open society. I kind of wished that some of the people around him would sometimes tell him that this is not working.
And even George Soros's friend, Leon Botstein, recognizes that his huge wealth sets him apart.
These people are the modern equivalent of feudal monarchs. The person with the money is an absolute monarch. There is no argument, no recourse. You can't vote them out of office. Their whim is your command. He's an enlightened feudal prince. He's not an arbitrary feudal prince. He's not a cruel feudal prince, but he's an enlightened feudal prince.
Some of his fiercest critics today are in his childhood home, back in Hungary. He's come under ferocious attack from the country's nationalist government in ways that are condemned by his friend Miklós Harasti, who is now a UN human rights rapporteur.
Budapest and the whole country is inundated with giant posters showing the three-story-high portrait of George Soros grinning, and then the caption says, "Don't let him to have the last laugh." He is the universal villain, the underwriter of everything that's evil, and past doesn't matter.
The charge against him is the familiar one, that despite his proclaimed love of democracy, he's using his money to meddle in other people's politics in an undemocratic way. Hungary has taken a very hard line indeed on immigration and refugees, and the government complains that its policies are being opposed by organisations which George Soros has funded. Zoltán Kovács is the Prime Minister's spokesman.
His worldview, the future of humanity in general, of the nation state, of political units around the globe, being a globalist view and representing open society as a philosophical program, is clearly not what we Christian Democrats, if you like, a conservative government, believe.
It sometimes seems that George Soros finds it as easy to make enemies as he does to make money. Why? I asked one of his friends and admirers, the Esperanto scholar Humphrey Tonkin.
I suspect, actually, because he's a lot more effective than most other people in achieving those objectives that he wants to achieve. If one is opposed to those basic notions of liberal democracy, then George is a formidable opponent.
Thank you for downloading this podcast. It was presented by Ed Sturton, produced by me, Claire Spencer, and Serena Tarling. It was mixed by Nigel Appleton, edited by Emma Rippon, and the production coordinators were Janet Staples and Josh Salon. If you enjoyed this podcast, you may like our profile of another billionaire philanthropist, Bill Gates.